from the southern port town of Amathus, indignant at the amount of sexual license that pervaded there, went so far as to suggest that Aphrodite should no longer stand as the island's patroness. To punish such blasphemous impertinence, the wrathful Aphrodite visited upon these sanctimonious sisters feelings of insatiable carnal lust, at the same time ridding them of any sense of modesty or shame. So cursed, the women lost the ability to blush and began eagerly and indiscriminately to prostitute their bodies about the island. A sensitive and wildly attractive young sculptor called Pygmalion saw the flagrant and shameless behaviour of the Propitides and grew so disgusted that he decided to forswear all love and sex in perpetuity. "Women," he muttered to himself as he set to work one morning on a commission to render in marble the face and figure of a general from Limassol. "You won't find me wasting my time on women. Oh, no. Art is enough. Art is all. Love is nothing. Art is everything. Art is..." Well, now, that's strange. Pygmalion stepped back to look at his work and wrinkled his brow in surprise. His general was taking shape in the oddest way. He could have sworn the man had a beard. Furthermore, the old warrior may have been a little on the tubby side, but Pygmalion was sure he didn't sport a pair of swelling breasts. Nor were his neck and throat so slender, smooth, and irresistibly. Pygmalion went out into the yard and dipped his head in the fountain of cold water that played there. Returning refreshed to the studio, he looked again at his work in progress and could only shake his head in bewilderment. The general, when Pygmalion had been permitted to go round to his villa to study the great man's features, had struck him as being constructed more on the lines of a warthog than anything human, and yet here he was, emerging from the marble as nothing short of a refined and miraculous beauty, a distinctly feminine beauty at that. Picking up a chisel, Pygmalion ran his artist's eye over the work and knew that with some merciless and well-aimed blows, he could easily enough get back on course and not waste the valuable block of marble for which he had paid a month's income. Crack, crack, crack. That was more like it. Tap, tap, tap. Must have been some weird subconscious urge. Chip, chip, chip. Or indigestion, perhaps. Now, let's step back again and see. No! Far from rescuing the work and bringing the general's masculine and martial glare back to the face of his sculpture, he had somehow managed only to amplify its soft femininity, grace, sensuality, and, God damn it, sexiness. He was in a fever now. Deep inside, he knew he was no longer rescuing the general. He was on a mission to see through to the end the madness that had seized him. The madness was, of course, the work of Aphrodite. She had not been pleased when one of the handsomest and most eligible young men of her island had chosen to turn his back on love. A young man, moreover, whose seaside dwelling happened to be exactly where Aphrodite had made landfall after her birth in the waves, and ought therefore, she reasoned, to vibrate with a special intensity of amorousness. Love and beauty, as most of us find out in the course of our lives, are remorseless, relentless, and ruthless. For days and nights, Pygmalion laboured on in a frenzy of creativity, of literal enthusiasm. Generations of artists in all media since might have recognized the agonized, breathless ecstasy of inspiration that had seized him. No thought of food or drink, no conscious thought at all, came into his mind as he tapped, hammered, and hummed. At last, as the pink flush of Eos and a nacreous flash of light from the east betokened the beginning of his fifth continuous day of work, he stepped back with the miraculous knowledge that only true artists understand, that somehow, yes, certainly, at last, it was finished. He hardly dared raise his eyes. All his work thus far had been up close, detailed. The lineaments of the complete figure existed only in some inaccessible dark corner of his mind. For the first time, he could take it all in. He took a deep breath and looked. He cried out in shock and dropped his chisel. From its exquisitely rendered toes to the perfectly worked flowers that wreathed the hair on its head, the sculpture was far and away the best thing he had ever done. More than that, it was surely the most absolutely beautiful work of art that had ever been seen in the world. To a true artist like Pygmalion, this meant it was more beautiful than any person that had ever been seen on Earth, for he knew that art always exceeds the best that nature can manage. Yet he saw that the figure he had rendered in marble from his enraptured imagination was more than the most absolutely beautiful thing now in the world. She was real. To Pygmalion, she was more real than the ceiling above his head and the floor beneath his feet. His heart was beating fast. His pupils had dilated, his breath was short, and the very core of his being stirred in the most powerful and disturbing manner. It was joy and pain all at once. It was love. The expression and posture of the girl, whose name he knew should be Galatea, for her marble loveliness was white as milk, was caught in a moment of sublime hesitation between awakening and wonder. She seemed a little surprised, as if on the verge of gasping. At what? At the beauty of the world? At the handsomeness of the young artist who was feasting his eyes so hungrily upon her? Her features were regular and perfect, but so were the features of many girls. There was more to her than conventional appeal. An inner loveliness of soul sang from her very core. Her lines were sweepingly, swoopingly, swooningly smooth, supple, and sensuous. Her breasts seemed softly to be pushing out. Her nakedness made so much more alluring by the way her hand touched her throat in a gesture of sweetly modest alarm. Pygmalion walked around her to take in the thrilling generosity of the curve of her buttocks and the glorious fullness of her thighs. Dared he put a hand to that flesh? He reached out gently so as not to bruise her. But his fingers met cold marble. Hard, unyielding marble. To the eye and through to the depths of her, Galatea seemed quick, warm, and alive. But to Pygmalion's stroking hands and to the loving cheek he rested on her side, she was as cold as death. He felt both sick and supercharged with life at one and the same time. He jumped up and down. He shouted out loud. He groaned. He laughed. He sang, he swore, He exhibited all the wild, deranged, furious, euphoric, and despairing behaviours of a young man tempestuously and frighteningly in love. At last, he threw himself at his Galatea, encircled her with his arms and with his legs, nuzzled himself against her, kissing and pawing and rubbing until everything inside him exploded. The madness that consumed his soul did not abate after that first frenzy. He now devoted himself to Galatea with all the ardour and attentive tenderness of a true lover. He called her affectionate names. He went out to the market and bought her gowns, garlands, and trinkets. He adorned her wrists with bangles and bracelets, and her throat with necklaces and pendants of jasper and pearl. He bought a couch that he adorned with silks of Tyrian purple. He lay her upon it and sang ballads to her. Like most great visual artists, he was an incompetent musician and a deplorable poet. His love was passionate and generous, but, except to his fevered imagination in its most optimistic moods, wholly unreciprocated. This was a one-way wooing, and in the depths of his bursting heart, he knew it. The day came for the festival of Aphrodite. Pygmalion kissed the cold but lovely Galatea goodbye and left the house. All of Cyprus and thousands of visitors from the mainland had gathered for this annual holiday. The great square in front of the temple was crowded with pilgrims who came to pray to the goddess of love and beauty for success in matters of the heart. Garlanded heifers were sacrificed, the air was thick with frankincense, and every column of the temple had been entwined with flowers. The prayers came thick, fast, and loud. "Send me a wife! Send me a husband! Improve my performance! Slow me down! Take these feelings away from me! Make Menander fall for me! Stop Xanthippe from cheating on me!" Beseeching cries and wails filled the air. Pygmalion shouldered blindly through the press of peddlers and petitioners. He reached the temple steps, bribed the guards, coaxed the priestesses, and at last was led into the inner sanctum, where only the richest and most influential citizens were allowed to pray directly in front of a great statue of Aphrodite. He fell to his knees before it. "Great goddess of love," he whispered, "it is said that you grant wishes to ardent lovers on this your festal day. Grant the wish of a poor artist who begs that you might..." At the altar rail, important men and women were babbling their imprecations to Aphrodite, and although the chances of Pygmalion being overheard were slim, some kind of modesty or shame stopped him from uttering his real desire. "A poor artist who begs that you might provide him with a real, living girl, just like the one he fashioned from marble. Grant this, dread goddess, and you will have won a devoted slave whose life and art will be devoted always to the service and praise of love." An amused Aphrodite saw through the prayer. She knew perfectly well what Pygmalion really wanted. The candles on the altar in front of him flared up and leapt into the air 9 times. Pygmalion flew home. To his dying day, he could not tell you the way he went or how long he took. He may have knocked over 1 person or 40 as he charged through the crowds. The lifeless statue is lying on its gorgeous couch just as he left it. Never has the carved figure seemed less accessible or more icily remote. Yet, with the faith and demented fury of the love-struck, Pygmalion kneels down and kisses the cold brow. He kisses it once, twice, 20 times. Then he kisses its neck, its cheeks, and wait, is it just the fire of his kisses that has warmed the marble? Or can he feel a growing heat beneath his hungry lips? He can. Beneath the touch of his mouth, the unyielding stone is easing into flesh, into quick, warm, delicious flesh. Again and again he kisses, and as the wax from the honeycomb softens and melts in the sun, so the cold ivory of his beloved softens from each gentle caress of mouth and hand. He is amazed. He cannot believe. He puts a finger to the veins of her arm and feels the surge and pulse of hot human blood. He stands. Can it be true? Can it be true? He cradles Galatea in his arms and feels her frame expanding as she takes in her first breaths of air. It is true. She lives. Aphrodite, I bless you. Aphrodite, greatest of all the gods, I thank you and pledge myself to serve you always. He bends down to meet warm lips that eagerly return his kisses. Soon the pair are in each other's arms, laughing, weeping, sighing, and loving. 9 times the moon changes before the union of this happy pair is blessed with the birth of a child, Paphos, whose name is given to the town in which Pygmalion and Galatea live out the remainder of their loving and contented lives. Just once or twice in Greek myth, mortal lovers are granted a felicitous ending. It is that hope, perhaps, that spurs us on to believe that our quest for happiness is not futile. Paphian becomes a word to describe Aphrodite and the arts of love. George Bernard Shaw chose Pygmalion as the title for his play about a man who tries to turn a Cockney girl into a Mayfair lady. Hero and Leander. The Greek sea, or Hellespont, is called the Dardanelles in our age, and is best known as the scene of some of the most furious fighting around Gallipoli during the Great War. As part of the natural boundary that separates Europe and Asia, these straits have always been strategically important for war and trade. Despite the size of the symbolic gap between them, they are in reality narrow enough to be crossed by a strong swimmer. Little is known about Leander. Christopher Marlowe's poem tells us nothing much more than that he was a youth who met Hero and fell in love. Leigh Hunt wrote another, which is no more informative. Leander's home was in Abydos, on the Asian side of the Hellespont, but he was in love with a priestess of Aphrodite called Hero, who lived in a tower in Sestos on the European side. They met during the yearly festival of Aphrodite. Many youths had been smitten by the meadow of roses in her limbs. In Marlowe's poem, she wears a veil of flowers so realistically embroidered that she has to swat bees away, and her face as pure as Cellini, but it was only the handsome Leander who awoke a like passion in her. In the brief time they had together at the festival, they hatched a plan that would allow them to see each other once they were back home and separated by the straits. Each night, Hero was to set a lamp in the window of her tower And Leander, eyes fixed on this point of light in the darkness, would breast the currents of the Hellespont, climb up, and be with her. As a priestess, Hero was sworn to celibacy, but Leander persuaded her that the physical consummation of their love would be a holy thing, a consecration of which Aphrodite would approve. In fact, he said, it was surely an insult to devote yourself to the goddess of love and yet remain a virgin. It would be like worshipping Ares but refusing to fight. This excellent argument won Hero over, and each night the lamp was lit, the straits swum, and love made. They were the happiest couple in all the world. All summer long this blissful state of affairs prevailed. But summer all too soon turned to autumn, and before long the equinoctial gales blew. One night the three winds, Boreas, Zephyrus, and Notus, north, west, and south, howled together, sending blusters and gusts all around, one of which blew out the lamp in Hero's window. With nothing to guide him across the Hellespont, and with the winds stirring up the waves into heaving walls of water, Leander lost his way, got into trouble, and drowned. The next morning, as soon as Eos had cast open the gates of dawn and there was light enough to see, Hero, who had waited up all night for her lover, looked down to see Leander's broken body spread out over the rocks beneath her tower. In an agony of despair, she leapt from her window and dashed herself on those same rocks. Leander's name lives on in England's venerable and exclusive rowing club, whose candy-pink socks, tie, and oar blades are such an alarming feature of the Henley Regatta. Since Leander, many others have swum the Hellespont, none more notably than the poet Byron, who managed it on May the 3rd, 1810, at the second attempt. In his journal, he proudly recorded a time of 1 hour and 10 minutes. "Did it with little difficulty," he noted. "I plume myself on this achievement more than I could possibly do on any kind of glory, political, poetical, or rhetorical." Lord Byron swam in the company of one Lieutenant Eakenhead of the Marines, who obtained his own share of immortality with his inclusion in this stanza from Byron's mock-epic masterpiece Don Juan. Praising his hero's prowess in swimming across the Guadalquivir in Seville, Byron writes of Juan, "He could perhaps have passed the Hellespont, as once, a feat on which ourselves we prided, Leander, Mr. Eakenhead, and I did." The achievement clearly meant a lot to the club-footed but superbly athletic poet. He wrote this to his friend Drury. "This morning I swam from Sestos to Abydos. The immediate distance is not above a mile, but the current renders it hazardous, so much so that I doubt whether Leander's conjugal powers must not have been exhausted in his passage to paradise." He even wrote a mock heroic poem on the subject, written after swimming from Sestos to Abydos. "If in the month of dark December, Leander, who was nightly wont, what maid will not the tale remember, to cross thy stream, broad Hellespont, if, when the wintry tempest roared, he sped to Hero, nothing I loath, and thus of old thy current poured, fair Venus, how I pity both. For me, degenerate modern wretch, though in the genial month of May, my dripping limbs I faintly stretch, and think I've done a feat to-day. But since he crossed the rapid tide, according to the doubtful story, to woo, and Lord knows what beside, and swam for love, as I for glory, 'twere hard to say who fared the best. Sad mortals, thus the gods still plague you. He lost his labour, I my jest, for he was drowned, and I've the ague. An earlier work of Byron, referencing Leander's home, though unrelated to the myth, is The Bride of Abydos. Shakespeare seems to have been especially fond of the story, giving a character in Much Ado About Nothing the name Hero, and putting these wonderfully cynical, anti-romantic words into the mouth of Rosalind in As You Like It. Leander, he would have lived many a fair year, though Hero had turned none, if it had not been for a hot midsummer night, for, good youth, he went but forth to wash him in the Hellespont, and being taken with the cramp, was drowned, and the foolish chroniclers of that age found it was Hero of Sestos. But these are all lies. Men have died from time to time, and worms have eaten them, but not for love. Arion and the Dolphin. The Greeks, like all great civilizations, set a great price on music, placing it so high in the arts that it took its name from all nine of the Daughters of Memory. Music festivals and music prizes, so ubiquitous a feature of our cultural life today, were quite as important in the Greek world. Few earned a finer reputation in their lifetime as singer, minstrel, bard, poet, and musician than Arion, from Methymna on the Isle of Lesbos. Only Orpheus, whose story belongs to a later age of heroes, exceeded Arion in skill and fame. Arion was the son of Poseidon and the nymph Onchaea. But despite this parentage, he chose to devote his musical talent to the celebration and praise of the god Dionysus. His instrument of choice was the kithara. The word guitar derives from the word kithara. It's a variation of the lyre. He is accepted everywhere as the inventor of the poetic form known as the dithyramb, a wild choral hymn dedicated to wine, carnival, ecstasy, and delight. With his dreamy brown eyes, sweet voice, and bewitching ability to cause the toes to tap and hips to rotate, he soon became something of an idol around the Mediterranean world. His patron and most enthusiastic supporter was the tyrant of Corinth, Periander. Tyrant is just the Greek for king. Periander was a real historical figure, cited as one of the so-called seven sages of Greece, who were mentioned by Socrates as exhibiting all the qualities of laconic wisdom to which mankind should aspire. It was Periander who found out about a big music festival being held in Tarentum, a prosperous port set in the instep of Italy's heel. Periander gave Arion the money to get himself across the sea and take part in the competitive elements of the festival on the condition that he agreed to split the prize money on his return. The outward journey was uneventful. Arion arrived in Tarentum, entered the competitions, and easily won first prize in every category. The judges and members of the public had never heard such thrilling and original music. A treasure chest of silver, gold, ivory, precious stones, and exquisitely wrought musical instruments was his reward. In gratitude for so generous a prize, Arion gave a free concert for the townspeople the following day. The Tarentum region was famous for the great wolf spiders, commonly found in the countryside all around. The locals called them, after their town, tarantulas. Arion had heard that tarantula venom could provoke hysterical frenzy, and so he improvised for the crowd a variation on his wild dithyrambs that he called a tarantella. The delirious rhythms of this folk dance, still popular throughout Europe, maddened the excitable Tarentines, but towards the end he tamed them with a medley of his softest, most romantic airs. By the early hours, he could have had his pick of any girl, boy, man or woman in southern Italy, and it is reported that, like the successful musician he was, he did. A large crowd was there to see him off the next morning, many of them blowing kisses and a good few sobbing their hearts out. He and his luggage, including the box of treasure, were rowed out to sea in a tender, where a small but serviceable brig, crewed by a sea captain and 9 civilian sailors, was standing off. Arion was soon comfortably settled aboard. The crew hoisted sail, and the captain set a course for Corinth. Overboard. As soon as land was out of sight and they were in the open sea, Arion sensed that something was wrong. He was used to being stared at. He was, after all, as outrageously beautiful as he was talented. But the looks that were being directed at him by the crew were of a different order. Days passed in this sullen and threatening atmosphere, and he grew more and more uncomfortable. There was something in the sailor's eyes that resembled lust, but suggested a darker purpose. What could be wrong? Then, one hot afternoon, the ugliest and meanest looking of the sailors approached him. "What you got in that chest you're sitting on, boy?" Of course. Arion's heart sank. That would account for it. The sailors had heard tell of his treasure. He supposed they wanted some of it, but he was damned if he was going to share his hard-won prize with anyone but Periander. He had earlier planned in his mind to tip the crew generously at the end of the voyage, but now his heart hardened. "My musical instruments," he replied. "I'm a kitharode."
"You're a what?"
Arion shook his head sorrowfully and repeated slowly as if to a child, "I play the kithara." Such a mistake.
"Oh, do you? Well, play us a tune then."
"I'd rather not, if you don't mind." "What's going on here?" The captain of the brig approached.
"Snotty kid says he's a musician but won't play. Says he's got a kithara in that box of his."
"Well now, I'm sure you won't mind showing it to us, will you, young man?" The full ship's complement had circled round him now.
I'm not feeling well enough to play. Perhaps tonight I'll be in better shape."
"Why don't you go below and rest in the shade?"
"No, I prefer the fresh air."
"Seize him, lads."
Rough hands lifted Arion up as easily as if he were a newborn puppy.
"Let me go. Leave it alone. That's not your property."
"Where's the key?"
I've lost it."
"Find it, boys."
"No, no, please, I beg you."
The key was easily found and wrenched from around Arion's neck. Low whistles and murmurs arose as the captain loosened the latch and raised the lid. Light from the glitter of gold and flash of gemstones danced on the sailors' greedy faces. Arion knew he was lost.
"I am quite prepared to share my treasure with you."
The sailors seemed to find the offer highly amusing and laughed heartily.
"Kill him,"
said the captain, taking out a long rope of pearls and holding them up to the light. The ugliest sailor took out a knife and approached Arion with an evil smile.
"Please, please, may I at least sing one last song? My threnody, my own funeral dirge, you owe me that, surely. The gods would punish you if you dared send me to my death without a cathartic obsequy of some kind."
"I'll stop you spouting those bloody words," snarled the ugly sailor, drawing closer.
No, no, said the captain. He does have a point. We'll let our Cygnus sing his swan song. I suppose you'll need this lyre. He fished the kithara from the chest and gave it to Arion, who tuned it, closed his eyes, and began to improvise. He dedicated the song to his father, Poseidon. Lord of the oceans, he sang, king of tides, earth-shaker, beloved father. Often have I neglected you in my prayers and sacrifices, but you, great one, will not neglect your son. Lord of the oceans, king of tides, earth-shaker, beloved. Without warning, clutching his kithara tightly to him, Arion leapt overboard and dropped into the waves. The last thing he heard was the laughter of the crew and the captain's dry voice. That was easy. Now for the spoils. If any of them had bothered to look down, a remarkable sight would have met their eyes. Arion had plunged below the surface and was fully intending to open his mouth and let the seawater in without a struggle. Someone had told him that drowning is a sweet and pleasant death, a slow passing into sleep, as long as you don't fight it. Choking is a terrible, panicky nightmare, but true drowning is a serene and painless release. So he had been told. Despite this comforting knowledge, Arion kept his mouth firmly clamped, and with bulging cheeks he kicked at the water, hugging his kithara. And then, just as his lungs were ready to burst, something amazing happened. He felt himself being pushed upwards, pushed hard and fast. He was surging through the water. He had broken the surface. He could breathe. What was going on? It must be a dream. The rush of the water, the bubbles and spray, the tilting, rocking horizon, the booming in his ears, the soaking, the roar and the dazzle. It all prevented him from understanding what was happening until he dared look down and through stinging eyes saw that he was on the back of a dolphin. A dolphin! He was riding it over the waves, but its skin was slippery and he began to slide off. The dolphin barreled and twisted and Arion was somehow righted again. The animal had deliberately manoeuvred to keep him safe. Would it mind if he stretched out one hand and held on to the dorsal fin, much as a horseman might grip the horn of a saddle? The dolphin did not mind. Indeed, it bucked a little, as if in approval, and increased its speed across the water. Arion slowly reached for the strap of his kithara and swung the instrument behind him so that he could enjoy the ride with two hands on the fin. The brig was out of sight now. The sun shone down. Dolphin and man ploughed furrows through the sea, sending up plumes of iridescent spray. Where were they going? Did the dolphin know? Hey, dolphin, set your course for the Gulf of Corinth. I'll direct you when we get there. The dolphin gave a series of squeaks and clicks that seemed to indicate understanding, and Arion laughed. On and on they went, chasing the ever-disappearing horizon. Arion, confident of his balance now, pulled his kithara back round and sang the song of Arion and the dolphin. It is lost to us, but they say it was the most beautiful song ever composed. At length they reached the gulf. The dolphin negotiated this busy shipping lane with graceful zipping ease. Sailors on the busy barks, barges, and small boats turned to stare at the remarkable sight of a young man riding a dolphin. Arion steered on the fins with gentle tugs this way and that, and they did not stop until they had reached the royal docks. Send word to King Periander, he said, stepping from the dolphin onto the quay. His minstrel is returned, and feed my dolphin.
The Monument. Periander was overjoyed by the return of the musician he loved. The story of his rescue filled the court with wonder and amazement. They feasted all night and into the morning. It was evening by the time they set out to see, praise, and pet the heroic dolphin. But a sad sight met their eyes. Ignorant dock workers had brought the animal ashore to be fed. It had languished overnight without any water to keep its skin moist, and then lay all morning and afternoon on the quayside, surrounded by inquisitive children, the hot sun burning down and drying it up. Arion knelt on the ground and whispered into its ear. The dolphin rippled an affectionate reply, heaved a shuddering sigh, and died. Arion recriminated himself bitterly, and even Periander's instructions that a high tower be constructed to commemorate the dolphin and glorify its memory failed to raise his spirits. For the next month, all his songs were sad ones, and the palace mourned along with him. Then came news that the brig, crewed by the 9 sailors and its villainous captain, had been blown by a storm into Corinth. Periander sent messengers to command the crew to come before him, bidding Arion to stay away while he questioned them.
"You were supposed to be conveying my bard, Arion, back from Tarentum," he said. "Where is he?"
"Alas, dread Majesty," said the captain, "so very sad. The poor boy was swept overboard in the storm. We recovered the body and gave him a most respectful burial at sea. Great pity. Charming lad, popular with all the crew."
"Aye, indeed, pleasant fellow. Terrible loss," muttered the sailors.
"Be that as it may," said Periander, "news reaches me that he won his singing competition and came to you with a treasure chest, half of which is my property."
"As to that," the captain spread his hands, "the chest was lost during the violent pitching of the storm. It opened as it slid down the deck and into the sea, and we managed to recover some small bits and pieces, a silver lyre of some kind, an aulos, one or two trinkets. I wish it had been more, sire. Really, I do."
"I see." Periander frowned. "Assemble tomorrow morning by the new monument at the Royal Docks. You can't miss it. There's a carved dolphin on top. Bring what treasure remains, and perhaps I will allow you to keep Arion's share, now that the poor boy is dead. You are free to go."
"Have no fear," said Periander to Arion, as he related to him all that had been said. "Justice will be done." Next morning, the sea captain and his 9 men arrived early at the monument. They were laughing and relaxed, amused that they had to return only a small amount of Arion's treasure and might even expect to be given a share of that by the gullible king. Periander arrived with his palace guards at precisely the appointed hour.
"Good morning, captain."
"Ah, the treasure. That's all you managed to save?" "Yes, I see what you mean. Not much at all, is it? Now, remind me what befell Arion."
The captain repeated his story fluently and easily, every word exactly the same as it had been the day before.
"So he really is dead. You really did recover the body, prepare it for burial, and then return it to the waves?"
"Absolutely."
"And these trinkets are all that remain of the prize treasure?"
"It grieves me to say so, Majesty, but yes."
"How then,"
Periander asked. "Do you account for the discovery of all this hidden in the hollow of your ship's timbers?"
At a sign, some guards came forward bearing a litter on which was disposed the bulk of the treasure.
"Aha! Yes. Well," the captain gave a winning smile. "Foolish of us to attempt to deceive you, dread lord. The poor boy died, as I said, and there was his treasure. We are but poor working sailors, sire. Your cunning and wisdom has found us out."
"That is handsome of you," said Periander, "but I am still puzzled. I had a kithera made for Arion in silver, gold, and ivory. He never went anywhere without it. Why is it not here amongst the other things?"
"Well, now," said the captain, "I told you how fond we were of young Arion, like a younger brother to us. Isn't that right, lads?"
"Aye, aye," muttered the sailors.
"We knew what his kithera meant to him. We included it with him in his shroud before committing his body to the waves. How could we have done otherwise?"
Periander smiled. The captain smiled. But suddenly his smile disappeared. From the mouth of the golden dolphin at the top of the column emerged the sound of a kithera. The captain and his men stared in amazement. Arion's voice joined the notes of the kithera, and these were the words that came from out of the carved dolphin's mouth. "Kill him, men," the captain said. "Kill him now and seize his gold. We'll kill him now," the sailors cried, "and throw him to the sharks." "But stop," the minstrel said. "Only let me sing one final farewell song."
One of the sailors let out a scream of fear. The others fell quaking to their knees. Only the captain, white-faced, stayed upright.
A door opened in the plinth. Arion himself stepped from the monument, strumming his kithera and singing. But the dolphin came and saved him. He rode it on the rolling waves. They crossed the sea to Corinth, the dolphin and the bard.
The sailors began to weep and blubber, begging forgiveness. They blamed each other, and most especially they blamed the captain.
"Too late," said Periander, turning on his heel. "Kill them all. Now, come with me, Arion, and sing me a song of love and wine." At the end of the musician's long and successful life, Apollo, to whom dolphins and music were sacred, set Arion and his rescuer amongst the stars, between Sagittarius and Aquarius, as the constellation Delphinus, the dolphin. From their position in the stars, Arion and his rescuer could aid navigators below and remind all of us of the strange and marvelous kinship that exists between mankind and the dolphins.
Philemon and Baucis, or Hospitality Rewarded. In the hills of eastern Phrygia in Asia Minor, an oak and a linden grow side by side, their branches touching. It is a simple, rural setting, far from any glittering palaces or soaring citadels. Peasant farmers scratch out their livings here, wholly dependent on the clemency of Demeter for the ripening of their crops and the fattening of their pigs. The soil is not rich, and it is always a struggle for the people to fill their barns with enough provender to last them through the winter months, when Demeter languishes and mourns the absence from the upper world of her bright daughter Persephone. That oak tree and the lime tree unimpressive as they seem when compared to the grand poplar groves and elegant cypress avenues that line the highways connecting Athens and Thebes, are nonetheless the holiest trees in the Mediterranean world. The wise and the virtuous make pilgrimage to them and hang votive gifts in their branches. Many years ago, a settlement had grown up in the valley below. It was somewhere between a town and village in size. It called itself, with that hopeful desperation that always marks out the naming of failed settlements, Eumenea, which means the place of the good months, in the forlorn expectation, perhaps, that Demeter would bless the barren soil of the place and provide bountiful harvests. She rarely did. At the centre of the agora, the main square, there stood a large temple of Demeter, opposite to one of almost equal size dedicated to Hephaestus, for the people needed their forges and workshops blessed. Around the town could be seen many votive shrines to Hestia and Dionysus. The sparse vineyards that straggled up the hillsides were as carefully tended as any of the olive trees or fields of corn. Life was hard, but the men and women here found much solace in the sour wine of their region. At the top of a winding lane leading out of the town, in a small stone cottage, lived an old couple called Philemon and Baucis. They had been married since they were very young, and now in their old age they loved each other as deeply as ever, with a quiet, unwavering intensity that amused their neighbours. They were poorer than most. Their fields were the meanest and most barren in all of Eumenea, but they had never been heard to complain. Every day Baucis milked their one goat, hoed, stitched, washed and mended, while Philemon sowed, planted, dug and scratched at the earth behind their cottage. In the late afternoons they gathered wild mushrooms, collected firewood, or simply walked the hills, hand in hand, talking of this and that, or content to be silent companions. If there was enough food to make a supper, they would eat. Otherwise, they would go to bed hungry and fall asleep in each other's arms. Their three children had long since moved out and were bringing up their own families far away. They never visited, and no one else was likely to knock on the door. Until one fateful afternoon. Philemon had just returned from the fields and was sitting down in preparation for his monthly haircut. There was very little these days to crown his bald old head, but this was a monthly ritual that gave them both pleasure. The loud rat-a-tat-tat on their door almost caused Baucis to drop the scissors she had been sharpening. They looked at one another in great surprise, each unable to remember the last time anyone had come calling. Two strangers stood on the threshold, a bearded man and his younger, smooth-faced companion, his son, perhaps.
"Hello," said Philemon. "How may we help you?"
The younger man smiled and removed his hat, a strange round cap with a shallow brim.
"Good afternoon, sir," he said. "We're a pair of hungry travellers, new to this part of the world. I wonder if we might trespass upon your good nature."
"Come in, come in," said Baucis, bustling up behind her husband. "It's chilly to be out at this time of year. We are higher up than the rest of the town, you know, and feel the cold a little more. Philemon, why don't you scare up the fire so that our guests might warm themselves?"
"Of course, my love, of course. Where are my manners?"
Philemon stooped down and blew into the hearth, awakening the embers.
Let me take your cloaks, said Baucis. Have a seat, sir, by the fire, and you, sir, I beg.
That is most kind, said the older of the two. My name is Astrapos, and this is my son, Arguros. The younger man bowed at the mention of his name with something of a flourish, and seated himself beside the fire.
We're very thirsty, he said, with a loud yawn. You must have something to drink, said Baucis. Husband, you fetch the wine jug, and I shall bring dried figs and pine nuts. I hope you gentlemen will consent to dine with us. We cannot offer rich fare, but you would be most welcome.
Don't mind if we do, said Arguros.
Let me take your hat and staff.
No, no, they stay with me. The young man pulled the staff close to him. It was of a most curious design. Was it a vine that was carved all around it, Baucis wondered. He was twisting it so deftly that the whole thing seemed alive.
I am afraid, said Philemon, coming forward with a jug of wine, that you may find our local wine a little thin and perhaps a little sharp. People from neighbouring regions mock us for it, but I assure you that once you are used to the taste, it can be really quite drinkable. We think so, at least.
Not bad, said Arguros after a sip. How did you get the cat to sit on the jug?
Ignore him, said Astrapos. He thinks he is amusing.
Well, I have to admit that was rather funny, said Baucis, approaching with fruit and nuts on a wooden plate. I hate to think, young sir, what you are going to say about the appearance of my dried figs.
You're wearing a blouse, so I can't see them, but the preserved fruit on this plate looks pleasant enough.
Sir!
Baucis slapped him playfully and went very pink. What a strange young man! The slight awkwardness that usually attends the drink-and-nibbles phase of an evening was quickly mellowed by the cheek and cheerfulness of Arguros and the ready laughter of their hosts. Astrapos seemed to be of a gloomier disposition, and as they went to the table, Philemon put a hand on his shoulder.
"I hope you will forgive the inquisitiveness of a foolish old man, sir," he said. "But you seem a little distracted. Is there anything we can help you with?"
Oh, ignore him. He's always down in the dumps, said Arguros. That's where he gets his clothes from. But in truth, there's nothing wrong with him that a good meal won't put right. Baucis met Philemon's eyes for a brief instant. There was so little in the larder. A side of salted bacon that they had been saving for the midwinter feast, some preserved fruit and black bread, half a cabbage. They knew they would go hungry for a week if they fed so much as half the appetites of two such hearty men. But hospitality was a sacred thing, and the needs of guests must always come first.
"Another glass of that wine wouldn't hurt," said Arguros.
"Oh, dear," said Philemon, looking at the jug. "I fear that there isn't any more."
"Nonsense," said Arguros, snatching it away. "Plenty left." He filled his cup, and then Astrapos's too.
"How strange," said Philemon. "I could have sworn the pitcher was only a quarter full."
"Where are your cups?" asked Arguros.
"Oh, please, we don't need any.
Nonsense!" Arguros leaned back in his chair and reached for two wooden beakers on the side table behind him. "Now then, let us have a toast." Philemon and Baucis were not only amazed that there was enough wine in the pitcher to fill their beakers to the brim, but that its quality was so much better than either of them remembered. In fact, unless they were dreaming, it was the most delicious wine they had ever tasted. In something of a daze, Baucis wiped the table down with mint leaves.
"Darling," Philemon whispered in her ear, "that goose we were going to sacrifice to Hestia next month, it is surely more important to feed our guests.
Hestia would understand. Baucis agreed. I'll go out and wring its neck, see if you can get the fire hot enough to give it a fine roasting.
The goose, however, would not be caught. No matter how carefully Baucis waited and pounced, it leapt, honking from her grasp every time. She returned to the cottage in a state of agitated disappointment.
"Gentlemen, I'm so very sorry," she said, and there were tears in her eyes. "I'm afraid your meal will be crude and disagreeable."
"Tush, lady," said Arguros, pouring more wine for everyone. "I have never partaken of a finer feast. Sir, it's true. Tell them, father."
Astrapos gave a grim smile. "We have been turned away from every house in Eumenea. Some of the townspeople swore at us. Some spat at us. Some threw stones at us. Some set dogs on us. Yours was the last house we tried, and you have shown us nothing but kindness and a spirit of Xenia that I was beginning to fear was vanished from the world."
"Sir," said Baucis, feeling for Philemon's hand under the table and squeezing it. "We can only apologize for the behavior of our neighbors. Life is hard, and they have not always been brought up to venerate the laws of hospitality as they should."
"There is no need to make excuses for them. I am angry," said Astrapos, and as he spoke, a rumble of thunder could be heard.
Baucis looked across into the eyes of Astrapos, and saw something that frightened her.
Agouros laughed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "My father is not angry with you. He's pleased with you."
"Leave the cottage and climb the hill," said Astrapos, rising. "Do not look back. Whatever happens, do not look back. You have earned your reward, and your neighbors have earned their punishment."
Philemon and Baucis stood, holding hands. They knew now that their visitors were something more than ordinary travellers.
"There is no need to bow," said Arguros.
His father pointed to the door. "To the top of the hill."
"Remember," Arguros called after them, "no looking back."
Hand in hand, Philemon and Baucis walked up the hill.
"You know who that young man was," said Philemon.
"Hermes," said Baucis. "When he opened the door to let us go, I saw the snakes twined around his staff. They were alive."
"Then the man he called his father must have been
Zeus."
"Oh, my goodness."
Philemon paused on the hillside to catch his breath.
"It's getting so dark, my love. The sound of the thunder is getting closer. I wonder if—"
"No, darling, we mustn't look back. We mustn't."
Disgusted by the hostility and shameless violations of the laws of hospitality shown to him by the townspeople of Eumenea, Zeus had decided to do for this community what he had done back in the time of Deucalion and the Great Flood. The clouds gathered into a dense mass at his command. Lightning flashed, thunder boomed, and the rain began to fall. By the time the elderly couple struggled to the top of the hill, torrents of water were gushing past them.
"We can't just stand here in the rain with our backs to the town," said Baucis.
"I'll look if you will."
"I love you, Philemon, my husband."
"I love you, Baucis, my wife."
They turned and looked down. They were just in time to see the great flood inundating Eumenea before Philemon was turned into an oak tree and Baucis into a linden. For hundreds of years, the two trees stood side by side, symbols of eternal love and humble kindness, their intertwining branches
hung with tokens left by admiring pilgrims. This theoxenia, this divine testing of human hospitality, is notably similar to that told in Genesis 19. Angels visit Sodom and Gomorrah, and only Lot and his wife show them decency and kindness. The debauched citizens of Sodom, of course, rather than setting the dogs on the angels, wanted to know them, in as literally biblical a sense as could be, giving us the word sodomy. Lot and his wife, like Philemon and Baucis, were told to make their getaway and not look back while divine retribution was visited on the cities of the plain. Lot's wife did look back, and she was turned not into a linden, but into a pillar of salt. Phrygia and the Gordian Knot. The Greeks loved to mythologize the founding of their towns and cities. Athena's gift of the olive to the people of Athens, and her raising of Erechtheus, the issue of Hephaestus and the semen-soaked fillet, you will recall, to be the founder of the city, seems to have helped foster the Athenian sense of self. The story of Cadmus and the dragon's teeth did the same for Thebans. Sometimes, as is the case with